This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we remember actor Andre Brouwer. He died last week of lung cancer at the age of 61. He's best known for his work on the TV series Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Homicide: Life on the Street, and for the films Glory and She Said. We'll hear two interviews with him, one that I did with him in 1995 and another that our TV critic David Bianculli recorded with him in 2006. We'll start with David's appreciation of Andre Brouwer.
When Andre Brouwer first came to television in 1989, after studying at Juilliard and playing Shakespeare in the Park, his arrival, like his performance, was nothing special. He played a second banana to Telly Savalas in a series of Kojak TV movie revivals. But that same year, he also was featured in a movie on the big screen. Glory, a drama about the first regiment of black soldiers to fight in the Civil War. And Brouwer was amazing. And after a few years and some other TV and movie roles, Brouwer landed the role that made him a star, won him his first Emmy, and gave him the platform and artistic collaborators to craft one of the finest dramatic series roles in the history of television. The role was Frank Pembleton, a Baltimore homicide detective famous in his own precinct for his skilled methods of interrogation. The TV series, which ran from 1993 to 1999, was NBC's Homicide: Life on the Street, based on a nonfiction book by David Simon, who learned enough about making TV on homicide once he started writing scripts to turn around and create HBO's The Wire, another of TV's all-time best drama series. Among those running the ship at Homicide were film director Barry Levinson and Saint Elsewhere writer-producer Tom Fontana. And everyone involved knew how invaluable Andre Brouwer was from the very start and wrote for him accordingly. As Detective Frank Pembleton, Brouwer was riveting, thanks to his way with a phrase and his almost musical delivery. One of his first homicide appearances illustrates this perfectly. Pembleton is reluctantly introducing a newly hired detective, Tim Bayless, to the daily routine. They're looking through one-way glass and observing a suspect in the interrogation room, known as the box. Pembleton takes the opportunity to treat Bayless, played by Kyle Secor, like the untrained rookie he is, while at the same time establishing his own authority and superiority.
What do you observe about the suspect, Detective?
Approximately 5'10", 150. He's got scratches on his left
cheek. No. The suspect is asleep.
Oh, yeah, he's been in the room for 4 hours.
Rule number 4. A guilty man left in the box alone falls asleep.
Are there any other rules?
Yeah. Uncooperative, too cooperative, talks too much, talks too little, blinks, stares, gets his story straight, messes his story up. There are no other rules. It's an expression.
Yeah, I'm hip. So you gonna interrogate him?
Interrogate him?
Yeah. I'm just saying that, you know, not a partner thing, but when you interrogate him, I'd like to sit in.
Then what you will be privileged to witness will not be an interrogation, but an act of salesmanship, as silver-tongued and thieving as ever moved used cars, Florida swampland, or Bibles. But what I am selling is a long prison term to a client who has no genuine use for the product.
A few more episodes into that first season of Homicide, Pembleton and Bayless, as tentative partners, stepped into that box to interrogate a murder suspect for an intense session that lasted the entire hour of TV. That Peabody-winning episode, written by Fontana, was called Three Men and a Dina, and remains one of the finest hours of episodic television ever produced, with writing, acting, and directing second to none. And that was just for starters. Homicide kept going for 6 more seasons, doing remarkable work the whole way. And Brouwer, whose seemingly indomitable character of Frank Pembleton was afflicted with a severe and debilitating stroke, was the best actor on television during his Homicide years. The fact that Homicide: Life on the Street is not available on any streaming site at the moment is as much a crime as anything its detectives investigated. The cast over the years included Ned Beatty, Melissa Leo, Yaphet Kotto, and Richard Belzer. Much of Andre Brower's TV work, after Homicide, also can be considered as hard to find as it is excellent. He won another Emmy as star of FX's Thief miniseries in 2006, but few people watched it. Or, for that matter, his outstanding work on the comedy drama Men of a Certain Age or the streaming drama The Good Fight. But he did get both attention and acclaim for shifting to all-out comedy in 2013 by playing an openly gay police captain in the Andy Samberg sitcom Brooklyn Nine-Nine. Once again, he found himself inside the box, grilling a suspect. But this time, it was with Samberg by his side. And this time, Andre Brower was having fun, especially with his own former TV persona as a tough guy interrogator.
Okay, we have a few more questions for you, Doctor.
Doctor? Huh? It's funny when people call dentists doctor.
We are doctors. We do 4 years of medical school.
Yeah, it's called dental school.
But we learn about the entire body.
Yeah, but if you had cancer, you can call a dentist.
You know, it's actually harder to get into dental school than medical school.
Why? Because there are fewer dental schools. Because most people want to become actual doctors.
That's ridiculous. It's not like we're college professors calling ourselves doctors.
It's not the same thing, my friend.
Well, sure it is. When someone has a heart attack on a plane, do they yell out, yo, does anybody here have an art history PhD?
A PhD is a doctorate. It's literally describing a doctor.
Maybe let's refocus.
No, the problem here is that medical practitioners have co-opted the word doctor.
Okay, Captain.
As Captain Raymond Holt on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Andre Brower delighted audiences for 8 seasons and was nominated for 4 more Emmy Awards. This time as supporting actor in a comedy. And at the time of his death last week from lung cancer at age 61, Andre Brower had completed filming 4 episodes in what sounds like yet another career-redefining role. He was starring as the chief White House usher in The Residence, a new Shonda Rhimes series for Netflix. We can only hope that if and when that series sees the light of day, that the episodes starring Andre Brower will be available as well as extras on a DVD or streaming site. And while we're waiting for that, could some streaming service please, please re-release Homicide: Life on the Street? The memory and legacy of Andre Brower deserves it. And so do all fans of truly outstanding television.
David Bianculli is professor of television studies at Rowan University. We're remembering actor Andre Brower, who died last week at the age of 61. Later on today's show, we'll hear an interview that David recorded with Brower, but first an interview that I did with him in 1995 while he was starring as Detective Frank Pemberton in Homicide. Brower had done a fair amount of Shakespeare prior to his TV work. I asked him about that.
The way that a Shakespearean character uses English is different than the way a contemporary detective speaks. What can you learn from Shakespeare that you can apply to contemporary film and television in terms of speech, intonation?
All of that work came to me from the Juilliard School. Communicating, breaking up the sentences into understandable parts and putting them back together again, the pure technique of speaking in order to be understood through complex thoughts. Shakespeare, of course, his thoughts are quite long and quite expressive and quite complex. And the actor is forced to think through the line from beginning to end. And it as opposed to modern speech, modern, I guess you could call it that. It's not broken down into short fragments, but rather longer and more subtle thoughts. So consequently, when I go over to Homicide, when I get a long sentence, I break it down into its component parts, and I use the entire sentence, you know.
Is there any way I could get you to take a line from Shakespeare or to take a long sentence from Homicide and show us how you break it down and how you actually analyze that line before delivering it?
Wow, I don't have a script in front of me. Let me think. So we're looking for a van that, I can't remember the line. We're looking for a van that does not exist, which carried kidnappers who never lived, which did not abscond with U.S. congressmen, and then didn't drop them off here. So the line, yeah, I think I got the line.
This is from last week's episode.
Is that last week's episode? Right.
Yes.
Last week's episode. So we're looking for a van which does not exist, which carried kidnappers who never lived, which did not abscond with a U.S. congressman and then didn't drop them off here, I guess, is what the other character responds. Now, that's a... That's a long and complicated thought, which you typically don't get. Typically, it's like, where is this guy? Or these kidnappers don't exist, or some smaller thought. And I relish the idea of taking a long thought, breaking it down to its component parts, putting it back together again, and being able to deliver it in one breath from beginning to end, and have it end up sounding like a question that I actually asked and have made my own, rather than sounding like a newspaper clipping or something to that effect.
You said before you loved Shakespeare even when you were young. What did you find when you were young in Shakespeare? A lot of young people don't like Shakespeare because it's such a different period and because the language can be very difficult to understand compared to contemporary writing.
This is my impression, that if your vocabulary is limited, then your thoughts are limited. And I'm not a man who wants to be limited, and I found something really, really beautiful in Shakespeare, something very spiritual and lovely in Shakespeare, and I'm not willing to give it up. I'd like to feel the kinds of feelings that Laertes feels upon hearing about the death of his sister, or when he sees his sister mad with flowers in her hair and talking outrageous gibberish and acting her behavior, acting with an incredible kind of sexual license that he's never seen her act with, he says simply, "Oh God, do you see this?" Now, a lot of people would say, what's wrong with her? Let's get her to a doctor. They try to solve the problem. They do a lot of different things. But Laertes is a very spiritual man. And he looks up and he says, "Oh God, do you see this?" It's a crime against nature in a certain way, you know? And his strange love for his sister is expressed in this way. It can't be beat. It can't be beat by cop shows, and it can't be beat by the most interesting kind of television drama. Shakespeare lives, and his characters express the deepest parts of themselves. Pimbleton doesn't express the deepest part of himself. You know, there's so many chameleon-like layers and aspects to Pimbleton's behavior and his speech and his relationships with everyone else. But in Shakespeare, I find the opportunity to really glimpse the most elemental and human part of a person.
Let's get to your formative years. I read that your grandmother taught you how to read before you even started school. What do you remember about that?
About my grandma?
Her teaching you to read.
Well, she read from the Bible, you know. She was a very, very religious woman, the sweetest woman I've ever known. And she would read to me from the Bible, and I'd look it up, and I'd keep reading with her. So when I got to first grade with the C. Dick Run and C. Jane Run stuff, I knew it already, you know. And I remember being, I guess, in third grade at a school called Spencer, which is over in my old neighborhood in Austin. And I could read so well that the teacher no longer called on me. So I remember going home one day and I told my father, I said, "Daddy, they won't let me read." And he said, "What do you mean?" He says, "Well, when we sit in a circle and everybody else reads, I raise my hand and the teacher doesn't call on me." And, you know, I never saw that school ever again. The next day I was in St. Thomas Aquinas, a Catholic school right around the corner. I didn't clean out my locker. I didn't clean out my desk. I didn't take my pencils away. My father figured way back in then, it must have been 1969, that education is life, you know, and without an education, you really can't make anything of your life. So I remember the most impressive thing about my father is he decided in that instant that his son was not going to be in a school where they did not let him read, and I was moved the very next day.
When your parents decided that you were going to go to Catholic school right away, did you thrive there? Did you like it? Were there things that you didn't like about the discipline or the uniform you had to wear?
The uniform, the blue pants, and oh my goodness. Things that I didn't like about the Catholic school. No, I actually loved it. You know, it was a very challenging environment, and I thrived in that kind of environment. I thrived with that kind of discipline, not because I believed that rules were made to be broken, but I enjoyed structure in my life. That same sort of discipline makes me sit at home and really break down a script into all its intimate characteristics so that I can do the best kind of work when I get to the sets. I love to rehearse. Homicide is not a show in which we get rehearsal before we begin the film. But in all the best work that I've seen myself do on television, and I see a lot of flaws in my own work, the best part of my work is always involved rehearsal. I remember back in 1992 when we did Three Men in Adena with Moses Gunn and Kyle Secor and myself.
This
in
was
the, box.
The interrogation episode.
The interrogation episode. We rehearsed every day 2 hours before we started shooting.
That was a great episode.
The homework we did in rehearsal showed up on screen.
What kind of homework did you do?
We would actually run through the lines, and we made choices right then and there. We rehearsed like as if we were doing a play. We found the best choice, not the first choice. We found the best choice, and I love the work that way.
When you were young, was it easy for you to find friends who were as serious about education and about other aspects of life as you were?
Oh, yeah, sure. You could find the athletes and the jokers and the scamps and the rascals. You could find everybody anywhere you'd look for them. I've been gifted by God to be able to take tests well. Who knows what I know? But if you give me a number two pencil, if you give me a number two pencil with multiple choices, I can just run roughshod over that test and make very, very high scores. And school has always been rather easy for me. Grad school was the hardest challenge I've ever had in my life because it's not about tests. It's about what kind of person you are. I went to Juilliard School as a very naive young man, full of myself, and I was exposed to, I was a member of a class with 22 fine actors, and I had to look down inside myself and find out what kind of person I was. I lost my mind several times at the Juilliard School. I was reduced to tears on many occasions, and I fought back to be this kind of man.
When you were reduced to tears, was that during a rehearsal or in class?
No,
in front of other people?
No, I remember my woman who I love and respect today, Liz Smith, my voice teacher. We were doing some poems by Dylan Thomas. I was doing Dylan Thomas "And Death Shall Have No Dominion." And I had worked so hard to improve my speech and my posture and my voice and the tonal production and all these different things. And I did that poem, and I thought I'd done quite well. And she looked at me, and she looked at me for a long time, about 15, 20 seconds after I'd done it. So I was saying, well, does she like it? Does she not like it? And she says, it was very, very well spoken, and your voice is improving tremendously, but it's rather boring, isn't it? And she looked around the room, and she looked for the assent of my classmates. She says, it's very, very, very boring. I didn't see any of Andre Brower in that. She called me Andre, as a matter of fact, Andre Brower. I didn't see any of Andre in that. And so I want you to do it again. Well, I was humiliated by that. I had tried my hardest, and I'd done my best to master the technical aspects of acting, and she was asking for me. She was asking for me to show myself, to show what kind of person I was and how I interpreted things. And she was asking me, do you know anything about being a human being? And I was reduced to tears by that, because I now knew that instead of faking my way through acting, by perfecting the technical aspects of this profession, this craft, I would have to put something of Andre Brower in this,
So where did you take it after that? Were you able to do it right afterwards, or were you really humiliated by the whole thing?
I was humiliated by the whole thing, and through my tears, I redid the speech again. And then she said, and of course, everything went awry, everything was bad. And she said at the end of that, she said, now that was interesting, I could have taken the wrong lesson from from what she was trying to tell me and created a very showy aspect of my personality or a fake humanism. But I think she wanted to see Andre Brouwer because that's really the only reason that we work in this profession. What she was suggesting is that there is a very human part to me and that I must show it in order to earn my keep in this craft, in this profession. That there's no point. There's nothing really wonderful about Andre Brouwer, who has mastered the technique yet refuses to show himself.
Andre Brouwer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure, my pleasure. Thank you.
My interview with Andre Brouwer was recorded in 1995. He died last week at the age of 61. Brouwer returned to Fresh Air in 2006 for an interview with our TV critic, David Bianculli.
I have some homicide questions.
Well, okay.
Well, one is, because I remember going down to visit the set at one point, and mm-hmm. I was amazed at the method of filming, which was to make you poor actors run through the entire scene from beginning to end with a single camera, shooting it from wherever it was pointing, and then stopping and doing it again a second or a third time. And I guess emotionally, it must be more exciting because rather than just doing pickups and close-ups, you're getting to the truth of the scene each time. But I also thought, man, that's heavy lifting. What was that like?
It was fun. It was fun from, I mean, it was fun. and I really, really enjoyed my time down there in Baltimore. I felt more like I was on stage than any other piece that I've ever been involved with. When we first started, of course, everything that we were doing, we were pushing the envelope in terms of how we were using the camera and the kinds of stories that we were telling. But subsequently, I mean, over the next couple of years, so many people adopted those same techniques that it's now become quite commonplace. But when we first started, it was unheard of to have a 16 millimeter camera sitting on Jean de Sagonzac's shoulder and running through the entire scene from mm-hmm. beginning to end. And Tom Fontana wrote long scenes. The one that I think back in particular from our first season was the episode 6 where Bayless, Pembleton, and the Araber are in the box basically for 44 minutes. Moses Gunn and Kyle Secor and myself sitting in the box for 44 minutes, and we would do huge scenes, page after page of dialogue, and then we'd stop and we'd do it from another angle. But in essence, we were doing a play. We were doing a drama in which it was just as dangerous as if we were on stage and it was happening right there before our very eyes. And we got a lot of very interesting, spontaneous human emotion by filming it that way. And I loved it. I absolutely adored it. Now, my subsequent shows have been different from that, but my love of the filmmaking on Homicide has never changed. I'm thrilled with it.
Well, I can tell you that I share your being thrilled with that particular episode, which was called Three Men and Adina.
Right.
And Fontana wrote it, and I have always held it up as one of the best hours of dramatic television I've ever seen written and performed. And it is the other clip that I brought in to play today, a piece from this, because I thought, essentially it boils down to your character of Frank Pembleton and Kyle Secor's character of Tim Bayless as two detectives who have 12 hours to try to flip a prime suspect played by Moses Gunn as the Araber. And so the scene that I want to play is at the very beginning, where basically at this early point in the interrogation, Pembleton is acting very friendly and very loose and very curious and polite. And it's Tim Bayless who's acting impatient and trying to push in and to ask questions about the young girl, Adina Watson, who was killed. So you ready to hear a little bit of this one?
Yes.
Okay, so here we go with Homicide: Life on the Street.
For the record, your name is Risley Tucker?
Yeah.
You live at 2003 Greenmount?
Yeah.
How long have you lived at the present address?
All my life.
Really?
No one in the neighborhood calls you Risley, do they? No one calls you Mr. Tucker?
No.
They all call you the Araber.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that term Araber has caused a lot of trouble around here. Two other detectives got into this big argument because one says Araber and the other says Arab. Both grew up in Baltimore, but they have different expressions for...
Mm-hmm.
I never heard of either not being a native, but it has nothing to do with being an Arab, right? I mean, you don't look Arabic or Arabian.
No.
So what does it mean?
We go from neighborhood to neighborhood selling fruits and vegetables from a cart, a horse-drawn cart.
Oh.
We're like nomads.
How long have you worked as an Araber?
All my life.
How long did you know Adina Watson? You remember the first time that you met her?
I'm sorry. This Araber thing, this fascinates me. Moving about the city, selling fruits and vegetables. I'm used to going to a supermarket, a food town or something, you know? Are your prices cheaper?
No.
Then what's the advantage of buying from you? I mean, other than the obvious one, you come to people's front door, people have to get in their car and drive 10 blocks.
Fresher produce.
What did you think about Adina? I mean, Frank and I here, we didn't really know her that well. What would you say about her personality? Was she feisty, outgoing, energetic?
Yeah.
So she worked for you how long? Doing what?
Taking care of Magdalene.
Magdalene?
My horse. Cleaning out Magdalene's coat with a currycomb, untangling the mane and the tail.
That sounds like a great job for a girl. Why'd she stop working for you?
Horse died.
There's any other reason?
My barn burned down.
That's the only other reason?
I stopped being an Araber.
Any other reason?
There was no more job.
Adina's mother didn't make her stop working for you. Huh? Isn't it true that Mrs. Watson was afraid for her daughter because you were getting a little too friendly with her?
Huh? Is being an Araber a good job? I mean, are you respected in the community?
Most people think of us as vagrants. But since the economy gone sour, you see a lot of people selling on the street.
Your whole family are Arabers?
You know, we had a sort of an argument beforehand about where to cut off this clip, and we couldn't
never stop.
We couldn't cut off the clip. It was just too good. It's not only great television, but it's great radio. What are your memories of filming that episode?
Well, we had, I don't know, 14 pages a day to do. My most visceral memory was we would leave the set and I would go home and I would sit down and I'd learn 14 pages of dialogue a day. But I do have to say Moses Gunn really turned into a very sweet performance in my mind, because it's never definitive whether or not that he had anything to do with Adina Watson's murder. But at the very end of the show, he says, you know, why should I be proud? Why should, you know, he's crying, he's weeping. He says, why should I be proud? Why should I be happy when I'm forced to admit that the greatest love of my life was an 11-year-old girl? And nothing's definitive by saying that she's the great love of his life. But what I begin to realize is that, once again, the great pathos of this episode comes from the fact that we begin to really actually realize that Risley Tucker loved this girl. And we're talking fictionally, of course, because mm-hmm. in real life we have no evidence to that effect. But this is part of Tom Fontana's genius, is that we are never quite certain as to what it is that we have on our hands, because evidence may point in one way and our feelings about the Araber may point in a certain direction. But Tom's genius is that he's written a man who's fully dimensional. So consequently, there is a tremendous amount of heartbreak and sadness on his part because Adina's no longer alive. But what I also think is interesting about what Tom did in this episode is that I came in firmly convinced that the Araber was not the man. As a prime suspect, that this was absolutely boneheaded, and that the rookie had gone out on a limb. And by the end, Pembleton feels quite certain that the Araber is the man. Is the man, and Bayless is not so certain at all, you know, based upon the same interview and the same information that we gained. So I really enjoyed working on this piece with Tom. Tom's written some dynamite episodes over the years, as has Jim Yashimura. Jim and Tom worked very closely together during those years, and I have to say they really turned in some spectacular episodes. Tom wrote the episode where Pembleton has a stroke. He wrote it over the weekend. He called me up and he said, Because I'd said to him, basically, I think we've played all the stories with this Pimbledon character, and maybe it's time for me to move on. And he says, well, no, I don't think so. He says, let me put my thinking cap on. So he came back and he said, he called me on the phone. Maybe it was Thursday he called me on the phone. He says, you know, Andre, I think I'd like to give your character a stroke. And I said, huh, that sounds really interesting. My only condition is that I not immediately recover and have a spunky therapist that I grow to love and all of the cliches that come with rehabilitation. And for me, the aftermath of the stroke, it was not so much about the rehabilitation, but how fundamentally changed all of our relationships were by the fact of Pimbledon's stroke. So his marriage is falling apart. Because he is absolutely obsessive about getting back on the force because he considers what he does to be vastly more important than holding his wife's hand or raising his daughter or anything. He actually rather would be standing over a dead body cracking jokes with his pals mm-hmm. in the middle of the night. So his marriage suffers terribly by the fact that he'll do anything to get back on the force, including not taking his medication so that he can pass the gun test. And whereas he was once the grizzled veteran and Bayless was the rookie, the power has changed absolutely in the relationship. And in a certain way, we flip places. So at one time, Pimbledon was first among equals, and now he's a much more humble man.
You had a long career in television even predating Homicide. And mm-hmm. if I have your early career right, where you came to acting fairly late at Stanford, I don't know if you finished all of your degrees and were out of Juilliard before you began acting professionally or if you were juggling the two. But
I came to acting, I guess I was 20 years old, somewhere in my sophomore year. I changed my major at Stanford University. So I graduated with a BA in drama in 84. Mm-hmm. And graduated from Juilliard 4 years later in 88. And then my first movie experience was Glory in 1989. We came out the Christmas of 89. And I did a little bit of television and a lot of stage before that movie broke, which began to create a reputation, I think, as a moral force, mm-hmm. a moral reputation as an actor. And I've done a variety of feature films, but television has always been my mainstay, and I enjoy television, so it works out.
Well, let's talk about two of those very early things. I mean, with Glory. You mm-hmm. were right there with Denzel Washington, who was just off of or still in St. Elsewhere, and Morgan Freeman and Matthew Broderick, and a very ambitious movie. And then the first thing I saw you on television was on the remake of Kojak with Telly Savalas. You know, and I'm sorry, I've been a TV critic for a long time. And
wow.
And I don't know if you're exhausted from answering Kojak questions, but I have one for you.
Okay.
You're doing Glory. You know, yeah. You're out of Juilliard. You're out of Stanford. And you're doing Kojak. What was that like?
It was a tremendous opportunity, and I think I was wise to be involved with it. It was my first experience with television. We were doing two-hour movies of the week, and I said to myself, you know, this is, I think, the right thing to do. It was one of the golden opportunities. Oddly enough, it was one of the golden opportunities that I was wise enough to actually go ahead and pick up. And so I look back and say, yeah, that turned out good. So I guess we did five or six of those little television movies, but I really enjoyed it and really introduced me to the craft of television acting. Acting is acting wherever you go, but there's certain things that you need to know about the pace of television work. And so so I was happy to be a part of that.
When you talk about acting on television and learning how to act on television, what did you learn from Kojak, from those early TV movies, that you needed to learn to be a better TV actor?
That the terrific pace of television demanded a tremendous amount of preparation in before I even stepped foot on the set. So I knew from that moment that I needed to be superbly well prepared if I was going to be able to be a success at this. The pace that we used on Kojak was so accelerated that if it was good for the camera, it was good. So on many occasions, everything was one take, maybe two.
Mm-hmm.
So in that way, it resembled almost watching, you know, daytime drama. It was very, very camera oriented. And I knew that in order to be successful at that, I would have to be very well prepared. So that the necessity of creating for myself a compelling and specific backstory, as well as knowing my lines in intimate detail and all of their import, meant that if I discovered anything on set, that I had a foundation for to deal with it. And that served me well in television. The pace has always been accelerated. For example, when we did when we came down to Shreveport to do the remaining five episodes of Thief this season, we had 5 days of rehearsal. Well, 5 days of rehearsal is an incredible luxury on television, and I made the most of that by making sure, in a certain way, while we were in rehearsal, to find out what was at the bottom of these scenes to the best of my ability, so that when the time came on set, I had already dealt with and discarded all of the choices that I felt were wrong, you know, so that the stuff that I was doing on set was much more of what I thought was the essence of Nick's character. I left a lot of bad choices in the rehearsal room, and for me, that was essential to reaching the next step with this character.
Well, your performances on television have been so much fun for me to watch over the years, so thanks very much. Thanks for being here on Fresh Air, Andre.
My pleasure.
Andre Brower speaking with our TV critic David Bianculli in 2006. Brower died last week at age 61 of lung cancer. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has an appreciation of jazz musicians who died this year. After a short break, this is Fresh Air.